keynote speaker, in addition to becoming an extremely famous person, Charles Ruben has also been a very close friend of mine for many, many years. Father Frank Ruben is the co-founder and national director of Priests for Life, and also the president of the National Pro-Life Religious Council. He has traveled in all 50 states and 5 continents, preaching and teaching against abortion, and helping other priests do the same. Father Ruben is frequently interviewed by the media on outlets such as the New York Times, the Washington Times, Hannity and Combs, the O'Reilly Factor, and many more. He was instrumental in the conversion of Norma McCordy, the Jane Roe of Roe v. Wade. He was also asked by Mother Teresa to address the clergy of India. In 1997, the Vatican asked Father Ruben to help coordinate pro-life activities around the world as an official of the Pontifical Council for the Family. In 1999, the Daily Catholic named Father Ruben among the top 100 Catholics of the century. In 2001, he received the Proudly Pro-Life Award from the National Right to Life Committee. And I can't think of any words that can express our deep appreciation for the tremendous energy and work that Father Ruben has brought to the pro-life community. My pleasure to be with you.
Bobby Schindler this morning, and to hear the tribute and for all of us to take part in the tribute that will be given to Terri Schiavo. I am not going to dwell on the specifics of the case because obviously we look forward to what they have to say about this, but let me just say one thing. The whole controversy that has been surrounding Terri, let no one in this nation think that this is about somebody's right to die because their suffering is too much. What this whole debate about is some other people's right to kill because their inconvenience is too much. And as far as the teaching of the church is concerned, or the position of Christians throughout the centuries, any judge, any court, any law that deprives someone like Terri of the right to fight or of the right to be fed or nourished, it's not a bad law. It's no law at all. That's not a problem. What I want to talk to you today, brothers and sisters, about are some of the dynamics that lead to problems like this. Some of the situations we face in our country now, especially as we approach elections 2004. Because what we do on November 2nd of 2004, in large part, will determine how many more Terris there will be, and how much more bloodshed there will be in this nation and in this world. I am not going to hesitate between now and the elections to be far more vocal than I have been in the past. Yeah. Because if the church can't speak at a moment like this, the church becomes completely irrelevant to this society. That's why the battle swirls when we come to an election season and people start talking about a phrase that is found nowhere in the Constitution, so-called separation of church and state. Now, let's reflect on this for one moment, brothers and sisters. We have to get a handle on what this phrase means and what some people try to make it mean. Of course, there's a division of labor, which is very legitimate, between church and state. The church does not have a standing army. The church does not deliver the man. The church cannot say that there are 51 states instead of 50. At the same time, the state does not administer the sacraments or lead people in Sunday worship or determine where pastors are assigned. The church church cannot say that there are eight sacraments instead of seven. So there's a certain legitimate autonomy, is there not, that we all acknowledge and accept and can live with. The problem is that people forget the third element of the equation. Because in our lives, in our world, in our nation, there is the church, there is the state, and then there is morality. And morality, brothers and sisters, overlaps with concerns of both the church and the state. And our founding fathers understood something. That the great experiment of self-governance on which they were embarking would never succeed. If God were separated from the state, or if the state were separated from morality. They knew better. Our founding fathers were religious men. They said so. We don't have to wonder about this. It's not a mystery. We just have to go back to what they wrote and to how they spoke. There are a few resources better than original intent, a book by David Barton of the Wall Builders. And David quotes page after page, chapter after chapter, in the writings of our founding fathers where they acknowledge Jesus Christ and their trust in Him for the remission of their sins. And their conviction that as this great nation took birth and expanded, that without an acknowledgement of God, this great experiment would never succeed. Listen to these words that the signer of the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Rush, wrote. He said, I sat next to John Adams in Congress, and upon my whispering to him and asking him if we would succeed in our struggle with Great Britain, he answered me, yes. If we repent of our sins and fear God. This anecdote, Rush continues, will, I hope, teach my boys that it is not necessary to disbelieve Christianity or to renounce morality in order to arrive at the highest political usefulness or fame. And we have to go no further than our Declaration of Independence to see that it is also a declaration of dependence upon God. Brothers and sisters, ultimately there are only two forms of government. There are many different sizes, shapes, and colors of government throughout the history of the world, but they ultimately fall into one of two categories. The type, first of all, that acknowledges that our rights come from God, and that government exists to secure those rights. And the other type says that government is the source of those rights, and therefore can alter them, and to subtract from them or deny them completely. Let's make no mistake about it. One of the things we're going to be deciding on November 2nd is which of those two types of government America will continue to be. Roe vs. Wade was decided in 1973, as we all know. And most people, if they even know about that decision or what it said, think that it was about legalizing a medical procedure called abortion. Well, of course, it was about that, but that was only one of its consequences. It is no exaggeration to say that the Roe v. Wade decision was the establishment of a different form of government in America. Because the decision did not deny that the unborn child is a human being. See, some people think that, they didn't know any better, or they didn't want to know, and so they just pretended that the unborn child isn't human, because, of course, if the child isn't human, then they can destroy it. But the court didn't say that. You see, if the court had said that, then at least it would have maintained a basic moral principle, which is that no government has the authority to destroy innocent lives. You see, because if you say it's not human, therefore we can destroy it, well, you may be wrong, factually, but at least you preserve the principle. But the court can do that. As to the question of whether this unborn child is in fact a new human life, the court said we don't know, and it's not up to us to say. And then on the very same page of the decision, they declare that this unborn child, we're not sure who he or she is not a person under the Constitution. You see what the problem is? Separating human being from human person. Separating human life from protection to the Constitution, and therefore declaring a new kind of authority. Namely, we can decide that some human lives don't have to be protected. Any candidate for public office who declares support for Roe versus Wade is declaring support for a different kind of government than what our founders established. law of the land. You know, a lot of people think that we're trying to establish a democracy. They did no such thing. Let me read what they thought about democracy. John Adams, quote, "Remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide." James Madison, "Democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths." What are the founders talking about? Did they establish a democracy? Well, when they wrote the word democracy, they had in mind the technical meaning of the term, which is that whatever the majority says goes. So that, theoretically, if the majority of the people said that murder was okay, it would be okay, and there would not be a higher recourse except that the majority eventually changed its mind. But our founders established instead a republic, not based on the rule of the mob, but on the rule of law. And furthermore, they acknowledge that there is more than one kind of law. Let me read on that point what the U.S. Supreme Court Justice and signer of the Constitution, James Wilson, said. He said, "All laws may be arranged in two different classes, divine and human. But it should always be remembered that this law, natural or revealed, made for men or for nations, flows from the same divine source. It is the law of God." Now listen to this assertion. He says, "Human law must rest its authority ultimately upon the authority of that law, which is divine." Let these words reach the great state of Florida. Let these words reach every state of our nation. Come they not from us, and not as a matter of opinion, but as the teaching of those who established this great nation. Alexander Hamilton, signer of the Constitution, he says, "The law dictated by God himself is, of course, superior in obligation to any other. It is binding over all the globe, in all countries, and at all times. No human laws are of any validity if contrary to this." Can they be more clear? Can it be more obvious? Can it be more certain that when a candidate for office stands up and says that it's okay to have the practice of abortion, when a judge stands up and says it's okay to starve somebody to death, can it be clearer that they have radically departed from the most fundamental principles on which this country was founded, and not just this country, but every civilized society? Now, brothers and sisters, we have experienced in this nation the Holocaust of abortion. Nationwide, throughout all 9 months of pregnancy, now for 31 years. And I have a question for public officials and candidates for public office who support the ongoing legality of this procedure. We have just been through court proceedings in New York and Lincoln, Nebraska, and in San Francisco regarding the partial birth abortion procedure. And we have had practicing abortionists take the stand under oath and testify to the details, not only of the partial birth abortion procedure, but of all the other abortion procedures. They testified about them all. And the transcripts of these sworn testimonies, not of what somebody else did or what some past history represents, but of what they currently do legally in this nation, those transcripts are publicly available. We have them on our website, priestsforlife.org. You can read them, you can download them, you can print them, you can quote them, you can spread them around. And the candidates for public office, those who are in public office, they can read them too. They're written in English. Well, of course, that doesn't necessarily follow. Here's, excuse me, the harshness of this, but this is sworn testimony that came out of another court case in Wisconsin just a few years ago by a practicing abortionist, Mark Haskell. He said, "When you're doing a dismemberment procedure, usually the last part to be removed is the skull itself, and it's floating free inside the uterine cavity, so it's rather like a ping pong ball floating around. And the surgeon is using his forceps to reach up to try and grasp something that's freely floating around. So there are several misdirections, misattempts to grasp. Finally, at one point or another, the instruments are managed to be placed around the skull, or a nip is made out of some area of the skull that allows it to start to decompress. And then, once that happens, typically the skull is brought out in fragments rather than as a unified piece. Now, we could spend all day quoting things as recent as this that have been sworn to in public courts of this nation. My question for public officials who say that they are pro-choice, my question for candidates who not only say that this is their position but campaign on it and say, we're going to make sure no one ever loses this right to abortion, my question to you is, when you say the word abortion, are you talking about the same thing? Just answer me that one question and I'll be satisfied. You can go off and say anything you want. But are you talking about the same procedure that has been described in courtrooms throughout this country? That's what I want to know, and that's what I want to hear the answer to from these public officials. Now, brothers and sisters, you and I may never get them to answer that question. But then again, you and I have a power that they don't have. We decide whether they get into office or not. Let's make no mistake about it. There is a wide range of issues about which we must be concerned. Poverty, education, housing, health care, war and peace, capital punishment, many, many issues that we have to evaluate, that we have to be active in advancing and protecting and enhancing the lives of our fellow citizens. But let's also make no mistake about it. Both from the point of view of the church and also from the point of view of common sense, among all the issues that we have to consider when we evaluate whom we're going to vote for, none is more important than the right to life. And let me explain why. I want to give a hypothetical here that might sound ridiculous. But what if somebody stood up and said, I'm asking for your vote, and I support terrorism. I think the terrorists have a right to do what they did. I would never advocate it. I would never do it myself. But I believe they have a right to do what they did. Now, if a candidate stood before you and said that, my question is this. My question is not whether you or anyone else would vote for them, because they wouldn't. My question also is, would you even ask what that person's position was on all the other issues? You wouldn't even ask! Well, sir, I disagree with you on terrorism, but what's your health care? Now, notice what we're saying here. We're not saying that health care is an issue. We're not saying that it's not important to look at their ideas about housing and education and war and peace and all these things. We're not saying that that's not important. What we are saying is, if a politician can't respect the life of a little baby, how is he supposed to respect yours? Oh, Bob Frank, abortion is just one of many issues. Yes, and the foundation of the house is just one of many parts of the house. Take it away and see how well you can build. All these other issues, all these other concerns are like the walls and crossbeams of the house. In fact, this is an image that, again, it's not the possession of one or another denomination. It's not a religious teaching that we're putting forward here. But this is an image that the United States Catholic bishops have used in their document, Living the Gospel of Life. They have said, abortion strikes at the house's foundation, so does euthanasia. And being right on all these other issues can never excuse a wrong choice in regard to the right to pass. And that's why I call upon those, if I can speak for a moment to those within my own church community in the Roman Catholic Church, whether you're a lay person or a minister in some capacity of lay ministry, or you're a deacon, or you're a priest, or you're a bishop. I don't want to hear anymore that all the issues are equal. Yeah. stand up and you say that all the issues are equal, number one, you're insulting our intelligence, and number two, you're contradicting the teachings of your own church. And make no mistake about it. Abortion and capital punishment are not equivalent. There is a big difference between the state, in certain limited circumstances, exercising its God-given authority to protect the rights of the citizens from someone who's going to destroy their lives when there is no other remedy, and the right, so-called, of an individual to put an innocent baby to death. There is a big difference. That if you count all those that have been executed by capital punishment in our entire history, it doesn't add up to the number of babies we kill by abortion in 5 days. And I just have not had enough of people trying to say that people are not pro-life if they support the right of this nation to defend itself, even in war, if necessary. If you believe that abortion is somehow equivalent to the act of the defense of the nation against those who are trying to destroy our lives, our rights, and our freedom, you have obscured the entire principle. It is precisely for the defense of life that in certain limited circumstances, states have the authority to use military force. It is precisely for the defense of life. It is not a contradiction. It's consistent, and brothers and sisters, another question that has to be asked, both the capital punishment and the war. When, in the exercise of any of those activities, do we deliberately target an innocent child? When? Again, an abortion is not even an abortion, by definition, unless you target and successfully destroy an innocent child. Now, some people think that elections are contests between candidates. They're not. An election is not a contest between two or more candidates. An election, brothers and sisters, is a contest between two or more teams. And the people of this nation have to decide what team they're going to be in each election in which they are eligible to vote. Because it is a team. It is the team better organized, it is the team more active, it is the team larger and more well-prepared whose candidate wins. And whose candidate wins? The team that gets more people actually out to vote. There are things that we can do, there are things that you can do, there are things that the church can do to call Christians and to call all citizens to their political responsibility. One of those things is to get them to register to vote. And some churches do voter registration campaigns. You don't have to rely only on the churches, though. Your groups, your organizations, your meetings, your Bible studies, your prayer groups. It is time now. In the meetings of those groups between now and whatever the deadline for registration may be in your state, that you use those meetings as an opportunity to get people to register to vote. And some people say, oh, but I only have one vote. Of course you do. You can only cast one vote, but you can influence thousands of votes. And that's what we have to call on our brothers and sisters to do. And how do they influence thousands of votes? Well, by getting others registered, first of all. Secondly, by informing them of the positions of the candidates and of the issues. One of the resources that we provided this year is a website, this is in regard to the presidential race, called votinginfo.org. Votinginfo.org is a C3-friendly website that will allow people to simply inform themselves on the positions of candidates. There are many other resources available on the internet as well regarding where the candidates stand. What is critical for people to do is to realize that it is not morally responsible to go into the voting booth and just vote according to the letter after the name. You have to look at the name itself and what that person stands for. Some people are in an automatic private booth.
Oh, my parents, my grandparents, my family, we always vote according to this political party. There is nothing wrong with belonging to a political party. There is nothing wrong with being loyal to a political party.
But there is something very wrong when our loyalty to a party is greater than our loyalty to God and the basic moral principle.
We've only just begun. I don't mean in reference to this talk because our time is running out, but we've only just begun in reference to this election. We must build a team that unashamedly, unambiguously, without compromise, says that we are going to use our vote this year to advance the culture of life. Because this is not a matter of pro-choice wins or pro-life wins. Brothers and sisters, if pro-life doesn't win, nobody wins. There is no victory in that. We at Priests for Life are at your service individually, your groups, your parishes, your dioceses between now and November. We are at your service to come to your communities and speak, to assist you with voter education and information and spreading the teachings of the church on political responsibility. In fact, speaking of websites, politicalresponsibility.com has been set up to assist the pro-life movement and all Christians in knowing what they can do and how they can do it and why they should do it as we advance towards election day. Let us make no mistake about it. God calls us to review the earth. He doesn't call us to sit back and just observe and then comment and complain. He calls us to be a community of faith that reviews the face of the earth. And you know what he said through his own son? The gates of hell will not prevail against the church, he told us. And we might think that that means, well, the church will survive all the attacks that are launched against it. Yes, that's true. But think about it again. In a battle, the gate does not run out onto the battlefield to attack the enemy. The gate stands still to defend the city against the enemy attacking it. When the Lord says the gates of hell will not prevail against the church, who's doing the attacking? Who's on the offensive? It is the church storming the gates and gaining ground for God and for human rights. And so I tell you today, the gates, the falsehood, will fall in the presence of truth. The gates of sin will melt in the presence of grace. And the gates of death in this nation, in this election, the gates of death will flee in the presence of you, the people of life. Do what you need to do. Christ is risen. Let us proclaim it and let us change this land. God bless you.